And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, today is March the 11th, 70th day of the year. 295 days remain until the year's over with. Holidays and observances. World Plumbing Day. National Dream Day. National Wash Your Nose Day. National Oatmeal Nut Waffles Day. Fill Air Staplers Day. Commonwealth Day. National Science and Engineering Day. National Salt Awareness Day. World Glaucoma Week. Brain Awareness Week. If you've got one, be aware of it. Universal Women's Week, Ramadan, Pulmonary Rehabilitation Week, famous people born on this date, Anton Yelchin and Rupert Murdoch, the Great Daffodil Appeal Month, National Reading Month, Veggie Month, National Sauce Month, National Peanut Month, National Colon Cancer Awareness Month, Epilepsy Awareness Month, Development or Disability Awareness Month, Brain Tumor Awareness Month, National Women's History Month, National Nutrition Month, National Hemophilia Awareness Month, National Social Work Month, National Small Press Month, Multiple Sclerosis Awareness Month, National Caffeine Awareness Month, National Umbrella Month, National Kidney Month, National Craft Month, International Ideas Month, National Credit Education Month, National Cheerleading Safety Month, Endometriosis Awareness Month, Rising Star Month, National Music in Our Schools Month, Irish American History Month, and National Athletic Training Month. And in 222, Roman Emperor Elagabalus is murdered alongside his mother, Julia Salamis, replaced by his 14-year-old cousin, Severus Alexander. Now, and you've got to put somebody that's 12 or 14 as the king or the emperor or the president or whatever you want to call him. It's a mighty sad situation. 843, Triumph of Orthodoxy. Empress Theodora II restores the veneration of icons in the Orthodox Church and the Byzantine Empire. Byzantine Empire was the Eastern Roman Empire. It became so large it was divided up into two, the Western and the Eastern. 1343, Arnost of Pardubice became the last bishop of Prague. A year later, the first archbishop of Prague. 1387, Battle of Castagnaro, Padua. Led by John Hawkwood, is victorious over Giovanni Ordelaffi of Verona. 1641, Guarani forces living in the Jesuit reductions defeat Bandeirantes, loyal to the Portuguese Empire, to Battle of Mabora in the present-day Panambi in Argentina. Man, these names. 1649, the Frondeurs and the French government signed the Peace of Ruel. 1702, the Daily Courant, England's first national daily newspaper, is published for the first time. 1708, Queen Anne withholds royal assent from the Scottish Militia Bill, the last time a British monarch vetoes legislation. 1784, signing of the Treaty of Mangalore brings the Second Anglo-Mysore War to an end. In 1795, Battle of Karda, fought between the Maratha Confederacy and the Nizam of Hyderabad, resulting in Maratha victory. 1845, Flagstaff War. Unhappy with the translational differences between regarding the Treaty of Waitangi, chiefs Onahiki, Kiwiti, and Mori tribe members chop down the British flagpole for the fourth time and drive settlers out of Kororikika, New Zealand. 1848, Louis Hippolyte LaFontaine and Robert Baldo become the first prime ministers of the province of Canada to be democratically elected under a system of responsible government. 1851, the first performance of Rigoletto by Giuseppe Verdi takes place in Venice. 1861, American Civil War. Constitution of the Confederate States of America is adopted on this date. 1864, the Great Sheffield Flood kills 238 people in Sheffield, England. 1872, construction of the Seven Sisters Colliery in South Wales begins. It's located on one of the richest coal sources in Britain. 1879, Sholtai formally abdicates the position of King of Ryukyu under orders from Tokyo, ending the Ryukyu Kingdom. 1888, the Great Blizzard of 1888 begins along the eastern seaboard of the U.S., shutting down commerce and killing more than 400 people. 1917, World War I, Mesopotamian campaign. Baghdad falls to Anglo-Indian forces commanded by General Frederick Stanley Maude. 1927 in New York City, Samuel Roxy Rutherfeld opens the Roxy Theater. 1941, World War II, U.S. President Franklin D. Roosevelt signs the Lend-Lease Act into law, allowing American-built war supplies to be shipped to the Allies on loan. 1945, World War II, Imperial Japanese Navy attempts a large-scale kamikaze attack on the U.S. Pacific Fleet anchored at Ulithi Atoll in Operation Tan No. 2. 1945, World War II, the Empire of Vietnam, a short-lived Japanese puppet state, is established. 1946, Rudolf Höss, the first commandant of Auschwitz concentration camp, is captured by British troops. 1977, Hanafi siege. Around 150 hostages held in Washington, D.C. by Hanafi Muslims are set free after ambassadors from three Islamic nations join the negotiations. 1978, there's been more death and destruction because of religion than almost any other issue. 1978, Coastal Road Massacre. At least 37 are killed, more than 70 are wounded when Fatah hijacked an Israeli bus, prompting Israel's Operation Latani. 1981, hundreds of students protest the University of Pristina in Kosovo, then part of Yugoslavia, to give their province more political rights. The protest goes on to become a nationwide movement. 1982, 15 people are killed when Widerøe Flight 933 crashes into the Barents Sea near Gamvik in Norway. 1983, Bob Hawke is appointed Prime Minister of Australia. 1985, Mikhail Gorbachev is elected to the position of General Secretary of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, making Gorbachev the USSR's de facto and last head of state. 1990, Lithuania declares independence from the Soviet Union. 1990, Patricio Aylwin is sworn as the first democratically elected president of Chile since 1970. That's Patricio Aylwin. 1990, Lithuania declared, 2003, International Criminal Court holds its inaugural session in The Hague. 2004, Madrid train bombings, simultaneous explosions on rush hour trains in Madrid, Spain, kills 191 people. 2006, Michelle Bachelet is inaugurated as the first female president of Chile. 2009, Wendenden school shooting, 16 are killed, 11 are injured before recent graduate Tim Kretschmer shoots and kills himself, leading to tightened weapons restrictions in Germany. 2010, economist and businessman Sebastian Pinera is sworn in as president of Chile. Aftershocks of the 2010 Pichilemu earthquake hit central Chile during the ceremony. 2011, an earthquake measures 9.0 in magnitude strikes 81 miles east of Sendai, Japan, triggering a tsunami killing thousands of people. This event also triggered the second largest nuclear accident in history and one of the only two events to be classified as a level 7 on the International Nuclear Event Scale. 2012, a U.S. soldier killed 16 civilians in the Panjshirwala district of Afghanistan near Kandahar. 2018, a Bombardier Challenger 604 crashes into the Zagros Mountains near the Iranian city of Shahr-e-Khord, killed all 11 people on board. 2020, the World Health Organization declares the COVID-19 virus epidemic a pandemic. 2021, U.S. President Joe Biden signs a $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan into law. For those that are not familiar with what the rescue plan was, it was a $1.9 trillion economic stimulus package. It was designed to speed the country's recovery from the economic and health effects of the COVID-19 pandemic and the recession. Why was they spending somebody else's money? They're extremely happy to sign whatever. 2023, the Burmese military kills at least 30 villages, including 3 Buddhist monks, during the Pinarung massacre in the Shan state in Myanmar. Well, that ends our little history segment. You know, there's been so much silliness going on running up to this upcoming election. And we've got CNN, which has done everything but urge people to get pitchforks and torches and storm Trump Tower to oppose the re-election of President Trump. If Trump was saying the things that, for example, Rachel Maddow is saying, he'd be up on charges of insurrection. But she's a star. But the problem is, they open their mouth before they put their brain in gear. And it leads to a lot of issues. And there's a lot of impressionable people that actually believe the silliness that comes out of CNN. Now, going to our story for today. Almost everybody knows who Bruce Lee was. Real name was Lee Yun Kam. He's only 33 years old when he died. You know, to master the art of Kung Fu requires tremendous dedication, concentration, discipline. Bruce Lee, who Hollywood promoted as the Oriental Clint Eastwood, had all these qualities. His international success was only cut short by his death. But as with other 20th century icons, such as Elvis and Marilyn Monroe, the circumstances of Bruce Lee's passing only fueled his mystique. In his death, he became a legend. Born in San Francisco in 1940, the fourth child of Eurasian parents, Lee Hoi Chuen and his Shanghai-born wife. His father was the veteran of the Cantonese vaudeville opera and was touring the West Coast as a singer and comic. Bruce Lee was initially nicknamed the Little Dragon. When he was 3, the family went back to Hong Kong, and already having made his movie debut in a San Francisco shot Golden Gate Girl in 1941, he made a series of feature films in Hong Kong. Usually he was cast as a short fuse, scowling ruffian, and off-screen he had a reputation as a tough young man, always in search of a street fight. Later on, while attending the St. Francis Xavier College, he studied martial arts. Peace of mind he found in that discipline helped him end his years as a troublemaking ruffian. 1958, the slight but muscular young man returned alone to San Francisco, attended the Edison Vocational School in Seattle and then Washington University, where he met his wife-to-be, medical student Linda Emery. And to support himself, he taught Kung Fu and opened his own martial arts academy. Hoping to break into films in Hollywood, he competed in martial arts tournaments, spotted in a Long Beach, California competition that has been cast as the Kato, the chauffeur on the action TV series The Green Hornet. He had the professional name of Bruce Lee and went on to play Kato, the faithful manservant who employed martial art and nunchucks to subdue villains. Well, when The Green Hornet was canceled, Bruce Lee opened another kung fu school. And his clients included James Coburn and James Garner and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Lee Marvin and Steve McQueen. Garner got him a small role in Marlowe in 1969. Another student, scripter Sterling Siliphant, wrote Lee into a new TV show, Longstreet, in 1971. That starred James Franciscus. Yeah. Bruce Lee campaigned for the role of Kwai Chang Kane in the TV series Kung Fu. But it went to David Carradine, who won the part. Wanting to prove himself to be a box office commodity, he accepted the offer of Hong Kong filmmaker Raymond Chow to star in the low-budget The Big Boss in 1971. It was a slam-bang action picture. Did very well in the U.S. Always eager to improve himself physically, he studied other forms of self-defense that he used in his future films. And with the increased worldwide profits of each new Bruce Lee movie, Warner Brothers signed him to star in the American-produced Enter the Dragon in 1973 with John Saxon and Jim Kelly. A number of years before that, Bruce Lee had said Hollywood is like a magic kingdom. It's beyond everybody's reach. Now with his fourth starring adult role, he was fulfilling his dream. Enter the Dragon was a huge box office success worldwide. Well, now Bruce and his wife Linda and their two children, Brandon and Shannon, were living in a plush Hong Kong mansion. Lee went to India with James Coburn and Sterling Siliphant to work on the concept of the upcoming film Silent Flute, which would, when it was made in 1979, it was retitled Circle of Iron with David Carradine. Back in Hong Kong, May of 73, collapsed on the set of Game of Death. Physicians decided he had suffered a mild seizure as a result of an epileptic-like disorder. Several weeks later, on July 20th, 1973, while at the apartment of actress Betty Ting Pei with producer Raymond Chow, Bruce experienced a severe headache. The Taiwanese actress offered Bruce a prescription painkiller containing aspirin and meprobamate. He took it and lay down to rest, and Chow left, and when Betty tried to wake him up, she couldn't. She phoned Chow. He came back and in turn called a doctor. Bruce Lee was rushed to Queen Elizabeth Hospital, where he died that night. He was just 32. Well, it seemed incongruous that the world's fittest man just died. Some sources insisted that Lee's strict health diet, which was eggs and raw beef and beef blood, had finally shocked his system. Other rumors exploded when initial newspaper accounts of Bruce's last day, in which it was claimed he was found at home, nearly comatose by his wife, were discovered to be a cover-up. Autopsy revealed that for some unknown reason, his brain had swollen abnormally through a brain hemorrhage, although a brain hemorrhage was ruled out. When traces of cannabis were detected in his stomach, the media began crying about drug abuse. Some insisted he had been poisoned with an untraceable oriental drug, or had been victim of the vibrating hand death touch. Well, that murder theory is based on the rationale that Bruce had angered martial arts lawyers by revealing too many trade secrets of the ancient fighting arts in his movies. Well, on July 25th, 1973, Bruce was given a royal funeral in Hong Kong with hysterical fans parading through the streets in the hopes of walking by his open coffin at the funeral parlor. 6 days later, the body was flown to Seattle, where it was buried at Lakeview Cemetery. Pallbearers at the Washington funeral included James Coburn and Steve McQueen. At the service, Coburn said, as a friend and a teacher, he brought my physical, spiritual, and psychological being together. Thank you, and peace be with you. Well, in several empty parcels with messages pointing to Betty Ting Pai as the holder of vital information came to the attention of Hong Kong police. They finally opened an investigation. beginning September 3rd, 1973. Actress admitted the truth about Bruce being in her apartment on the final day. When she explained about giving him aquagesic, the coroner brought in the verdict of death by misadventure, concluding he had died from a strong reaction to ingredients in the medication that caused brain swelling. Despite the evidence, many fans have refused to accept the final verdict and the truth, and they stick firmly to their wild speculations. I like the vibrating hand, personally. Well, Bruce's untimely death only increased his box office appeal, and everybody seemed to jump on the financial bandwagon. His earlier movies were released, TV appearances were re-edited into features, and the merchandising of memorabilia was enormous. Several specious documentaries were produced on his life. Several imitation kung fu stars, including Bruce Lee, that's spelled L-I, suddenly appeared to star and rip off kung fu entries, which promotional campaigns that insisted Bruce Lee lives. Well, Lee's footage from the interrupted Game of Death, touted to be more than 100 minutes, was used in a 1978 release by that name. But in the revamped plotline, Bruce was only seen in a few minutes of the fight footage, with obvious doubles padding out his long-delayed last appearance. Well, there's still a lot of questions to be answered. Unfortunately, nobody knows what the answers might be. Well, from Bruce Lee, let's go talk about Norma Jean Mortensen Baker. You know her better as Marilyn Monroe. Died in 1962. You know, few 20th century personalities generated as much enthusiasm, analysis, and worship as Marilyn Monroe. She was a vulnerable little lost girl who became a legendary screen star, blessed with a startling figure, a captivating walk, and a whispery, childish voice. And her life was full of contradictions. She was a tremendous sex symbol who had grave misgivings about her sexual appeal and abilities, and she far more wanted to be a mother than just another screen siren. Some of the sharpest commentary about this confused blonde bombshell originated from fellow artists. According to Laurence Olivier, there were two entirely unrelated sides of Marilyn. You wouldn't be far out if you described her as schizoid. Two people that she was could hardly have been more different. She was so adorable, so witty, such incredible fun, and more physically attractive than anybody I could have imagined apart from herself on the screen. And according to director Billy Wilder, for what you finally got on the screen, she was worth every hour you had to wait for her. I wish she was around today. How often do you have a face like hers that lights up a screen? Arthur Miller, one of her ex-husbands, said what she wanted most was not to judge, but to win recognition from a sentimentally cruel profession. And for men, blinded to her humanity by her perfect beauty. She is part queen, part waif, sometimes on her knees before her own body, and sometimes despairing because of it. And for Marilyn Monroe herself, she said, I always felt insecure and in the way, but most of all, I was scared. I guess I wanted love more than anything else in the world. Certainly a portion of Monroe's enduring fame stems from her sudden death at the age of 36. At first, a lot of the public agreed with the official verdict her death was most probably a suicide. It was simpler to accept that this love goddess was another victim of career and personal insecurities and label her a casualty of her own profession. But as the years went by and the persistent probing into her clouded passing refused to disappear, and an increasing number of people have come to believe that her romantic involvement with the Kennedy clan members, first was then Senator John F. and later with Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy, might well have played a far greater role than many ever suspected in her accidental self-induced death from a pill overdose. A lot of folks who insist she was murdered also insist a conspiracy existed to cover up the homicide. Well, she was born Norma Jean Baker in 1926 in Los Angeles. She was illegitimate, and that had something to do with her emotional outlook. Her mother, Gladys Pearl Monroe Mortensen, had two children by a previous marriage, was a 25-year-old film lab worker who would spend most of her subsequent life in mental institutions. Norma Jean's unhappy childhood is played out in a succession of foster homes and orphanages. At the age of 8, in one of these temporary setups, she was raped. And on the One of the side effects of her emotional scarring during her childhood was her tendency to stutter. June of 1942, 16-year-old Norma Jean married 21-year-old James Daughtry, an aircraft factory worker. She did it to escape being sent to yet another foster home. And while Daughtry was serving in the Merchant Marines in World War II, she was employed in the San Fernando Valley Defense Plant and began posing for local photographers, typically in form-fitting sweaters. Further modeling work led to national magazine layouts, which in turn brought her to the attention of 20th Century Fox. Outfitted with a new name, Marilyn Monroe, she was signed by the studio. That same year, she divorced Daughtry. At Fox, Marilyn appeared in the Dangerous Years in 47 before she was dropped and made Ladies of the Chorus in 48 at Columbia. During this period, she dated vocal coach Fred Karger, and when he dropped her, she attempted suicide. And because of a good friend, John Hyde, her agent and boyfriend, she won small but showy screen roles in The Asphalt Jungle in 1950 and All About Eve in 1950. Next, Hyde, already dying, injured her return to 20th Century Fox. Well, Monroe had a talent for promoting herself with the correct people. Soon made a Blasé Fox studio interested in promoting her career at a renegotiated $500 a week. Now, that was serious money in the 50s. Her 1949 nude calendar pose photo surfaced, giving her career a surprise boost. She proved to be more than a bus line with her dramatic work in Don't Bother to Knock in 52 and Niagara in 53. By the time she did How to Marry a Millionaire in 1953, she was the queen of the Fox lot. But on set, she was a problem, addicted to temperament and tardiness. At this stage, she was controlled by her acting coach, Natasha Lettice. 1954, she married Joe DiMaggio, the celebrated 38-year-old baseball player. He hoped she'd abandon her career to become a housewife, and he actually grew frustrated and jealous, being Mr. Monroe. As a result, they soon divorced, and now single, Monroe resisted her studio, and despite a 7-year contract, departed from New York. Disciple of Strasberg's method acting. And soon Strasberg's wife, Paula, became her manipulative acting coach. Well, the new Marilyn debuted in Bus Stop in 1956 to terrific reviews. Increasingly unmanageable, she rejected a rash of movie projects despite a newly revised Fox contract. And meanwhile, her dependency on pills and drink, especially Dom Perignon champagne, accelerated. In June of 56, she married the older, famous playwright Arthur Miller in White Plains, New York. Case of an intellect and love with a culture-hungry sex goddess. For her own production company, she traipsed to England to co-star with Laurence Olivier in The Prince and the Showgirl in 58. Well, that film proved to be a semi-dud. The next year, she bounced back with the classic Something Like It Hot. Unfortunately, the next picture was Let's Make Love in 1960, where she and French co-star Yves Montand exhibited far more chemistry off-camera than on. The movie, unfortunately, flopped. Miller had written and rewritten The Misfits in 1961 as a vehicle for Marilyn. Well, by now, the combined effects of pills and drink, emotional breakdowns, and miscarriages weighed the actress down. She looked and acted forlorn, much like her co-star Montgomery Clift, who in 66 would die of a drug overdose. The making of The Misfits, which was a commercial disappointment, was a saga unto itself. Not long after its completion, Clark Gable, who was the star, died in November 1960 of a heart attack. He'd suffered from Marilyn's own set artistic temperament in a rough desert location filming. January 1961, Monroe and Miller divorced. Distraught, Marilyn underwent psychiatric treatment at Manhattan's Payne Whitney Clinic. Well, by 1962, she had settled into a modest one-story stucco ranch-style house on Fifth Helena Drive in Brentwood, first place she ever owned. Lived there alone except for her housekeeper, Ms. Eunice Murray, and her little dog. Closest friend at the time was said to be longtime pal Robert Slatzer, who alleged to have been married secretly to her at one brief point in the 50s. Well, she went on to star with Something's Gotta Give with Dean Martin at Fox. Although physically in peak form, emotionally it was the Same sad story. She frequently was absent from the set, claiming illness. However, when she appeared in New York to sing Happy Birthday to President Kennedy, the studio was livid. They were appeased, however, when Marilyn returned it a lot and was more cooperative than usual. June 1st, she celebrated her 36th birthday with an on-the-set party. But by the following Thursday, June 7th, she was fired from the picture for unprofessional antics. Fox filed a $750,000 lawsuit against her, but later agreed quietly to leave her to have her complete the project once co-star Dean Martin completed other commitments. Meanwhile, Marilyn was contemplating movie and stage, including Las Vegas offers, as well as a possibility of a Playboy magazine layout. After a short visit in New York City and Mexico City, she returned home. Supposedly, during this period, she underwent an abortion. Well, the very lonely Marilyn spent her last days holed up at home. Her romance with the married Robert Kennedy reached a stalemate. He refused to accept her phone calls. And she remained persistent in her romantic demands, threatening to make public her romance with him. Saturday, August 4th, 1962, she was at home all day. Her only guest was Pat Newcomb, her publicist. Later reports hinted Robert Kennedy might have visited her that afternoon. About 5 p.m., her psychoanalyst, Dr. Ralph Greenson, came to her for a therapy session. He suggested she go for a drive to relax. Instead, she remained at home and retired to her bedroom about 8 p.m., taking the phone from the hall into the bedroom with her and having several conversations. It was known she made several phone calls that evening. She talked to Joe DiMaggio Jr., San Francisco, to discuss his breakup with a recent girlfriend. Talked to Dr. Peter Lawford, who in past years had introduced her to his brother-in-laws, John F. and Robert F. Kennedy. That call was about 6 p.m., and its subject was to cancel a dinner invitation. Allegedly, she said to Lawford, Peter, I don't think I'm going to make it tonight because I just don't feel well. Do you say goodbye to Pat and to Jack and to yourself because you're a nice guy? Supposedly, Lawford became concerned about her goodbye message and wanted to rush over there, but was advised not to because of the adverse publicity it would generate, being the president's brother-in-law, you know. Lawford later claimed he contacted Monroe's agent, who in turn called Monroe's house. Ms. Murray answered the 9:30 call and said the telephone cord was still in Marilyn's room and she must be okay. Because Marilyn had difficulty sleeping, even with sleeping pills, she typically put the phone outside her room, so once she went to bed at night, she wouldn't be disturbed. Well, what other calls she might have made or received that night is not known because telephone records for her last evening vanished after being taken by authorities from the phone company office. According to the official story of her death after midnight, later that time was changed to 3:25 a.m. on August 6th, Ms. Murray noticed a light shining from under Marilyn's bedroom door. But Marilyn didn't respond to her knocking. She went outside and peered through the closed French window doors. She saw Marilyn on the bed looking peculiar. She called Dr. Greenson. When he arrived, he broke a pane in the French window and opened the door. After he looked at her, he called her personal physician, Dr. Hyman Engelberg, who pronounced Marilyn dead. Well, about 4:20 in the afternoon, the police were called. Now, what happened in that almost 12-hour time frame? Nobody knows. When Los Angeles Police Department Sergeant Jack Clemens arrived, he found several people there, including the two doctors, Ms. Murray, Ms. Murray's son-in-law, Marilyn's gardener, Pat Newcomb, and Inez Melson, the legal guardian of Marilyn's mother. In Clemens' words, it looked like a convention. Something just was not kosher. Well, Clemens stated he found the movie star lying naked, face down and catacornered on her bed in the sparsely furnished master bedroom, with her outstretched arm apparently reaching for a nearby phone. Empty bottle of sleeping pills was found next to the bed with 10 to 14 other bottles on the nightstand, including one containing 10 capsules of chlorohydrate. Well, her body was taken to Westwood Village Mortuary while the house was sealed and placed under guard. Later, the corpse was transferred to the county morgue, where Los Angeles County Deputy Medical Examiner and Pathologist Dr. Thomas Noguchi conducted a high-profile autopsy. In his book, Coroner, in 1983, he pled naivete to the in the case due to his youth and incompetence. At another time, he indicated being pressured by his superiors into signing his questionable original autopsy report on Marilyn's death. No question in anybody's mind it was a cover-up. The question is, what were they covering up? Investigation linked her death, listed her death as a result of a lethal dose of Nimbitol and perchlorohydrate, determined a probable suicide. Joe DiMaggio, who after their divorce had stayed in touch, flew down from San Francisco to supervise the funeral arrangements. At the service, Lee Strasberg delivered the eulogy. Marilyn was buried in Westwood Village Memorial Park. And to this day, red roses are placed in a vase attached to the crypt, courtesy of DiMaggio. In her will, she left a $100,000 trust fund for her mother, who was institutionalized at the time. She died at the age of 83 in March of 84. Marilyn bequeathed another portion of a trust and a quarter of the residuary estate to her then psychotherapist, Dr. Mary Ann Criss. Dr. Criss died in 1980, leaving her estate share to what became the Anna Freud Center for the Psychoanalytic Study and Treatment of Children in London. A large portion of Marilyn's estate went to her acting mentor, Lee Strasberg. When he died in 1982, his entire portion passed to his widow, Anna. But due to tax and other debts outstanding at the time of her death, it wasn't until 7 years after Monroe's passing that her estate was straightened out. Now, though, proceeds from her films, the merchandising of her image, the Monroe estate earns about $1 million annual, most of the proceeds going to Anna Strasberg. Well, a year after she died, Marilyn's studio issued a documentary entitled Marilyn. It contained footage of her aborted final movie, which Fox revamped into a Doris Day vehicle. It's entitled Move Over, Darling. Came out in 63. Increasingly over the years, observers have wondered about the puzzling, contradictory case and the facts and speculation about her death. There were indications her body had been moved from somewhere else and repositioned on the bed. A particular delay ranging from a few minutes to 4 hours before the two physicians on the scene summoned the police has raised questions. The doctors claim there was a brief lag time because of a discussion whether to first notify the police or a mortuary. There was no drink glass near the dead actress, with which she could have washed down the 47 pills that allegedly killed her. Mortuary workers who transported her corpse from her house that morning were surprised to be told she died only a few hours earlier, since advanced rigor mortis had already set in. The autopsy revealed a high barbiturate level in her bloodstream, allegedly the result of ingesting 40 to 50 pills, but peculiarly no test was made of her small intestine for traces of unabsorbed pills, and no pill residue was found in her internal organs or in the stomach. Monroe usually swallowed pills with milk, but there was no milk traces in her stomach lining. The bruise on the left hip gave rise to the theory she might have been injected with a lethal dosage. Another conjecture was she had been given a fatal suppository or enema, as Monroe took enemas as a way to diet. Post-mortem symptoms indicated that for a period after death she had been lying on her back, but the police found her lying flat on her stomach. Monroe's diary also vanished after being taken to the coroner's office with other pertinent possessions. Robert Kennedy, who claimed to have been in Northern California with his family on the night of August 4th and the day of August 5th, supposedly made a secret trip to L.A. on that Saturday and flew back north by helicopter. And, of course, the lack of any suicide note was also very telling. Despite the wealth of contradictory facts and testimony recorded or covered up at the time of Marilyn's death, no charges were ever pressed in the matter. During the intervening years, many of the major knowledgeable parties have died. Peter Lawford, Los Angeles Police Department Chief William Parker, FBI Chief J. M. who covered up Hoover. Others have been assassinated, John and Robert Kennedy. And much evidence has simply vanished. 1985, from pressure publicity of new books on Monroe and TV documentaries, the L.A. County Grand Jury was asked to re-examine Marilyn's death, but the jury's Criminal Justice Committee recommended against reopening the still controversial case. And the mystery goes on. Well, You know, very few people seem to take into consideration that Marilyn had what many described as pillow talk sessions with both Robert and John Kennedy. And there was always the possibility that they had revealed things that they shouldn't. And Marilyn was not the dumb blonde she pretended to be. She was quite an intelligent young lady. And sometimes when you get information that that has a monetary value, you tend to use it. So there's just too many questions in regard to Marilyn's death for it to have been simply a suicide. Well, the next one on our list of very puzzling deaths was Elvis Presley. Died in 1977. You know, even now, years after Presley's death, many fans refuse to accept that the king, as he was called, is gone. The phenomenon of Elvis sightings is more cause for astonishment than ridicule. And it's but one of many manifestations of global Elvis mania, along with the enshrinement of his Graceland estate, continued high sales of his albums and movies, and the mass merchandising of Presley memorabilia. Obviously, the public deeply misses this young man, and you know, the 20th century icon is so revered by so many. He was born Elvis Aaron Presley, January 8, 1935, in Tupelo, Mississippi. He was the son of a farm laborer, Vernon Elvis Presley, and his sewing machine operator wife, Gladys Smith Presley. There was a twin brother who died at birth. At an early age, the extremely polite boy was more drawn to singing than school studies, began vocalizing at church, the Assembly of God camp meetings that his family attended. And in my misspent youth, I went to a few of those. Very strange. For his 12th birthday, he wanted a bicycle, but his mother couldn't afford one, but did manage to buy him a $12.95 guitar, taught himself to play it, and soon became fascinated with the blues and country music he heard on the radio. By 1948, the family moved to Memphis, Tennessee, where Vernon worked at a paint factory, and Elvis went to Humes High School. After graduation, he had a variety of jobs, including ones as factory worker and truck driver. Made an unbelievable $35 a week. One time, he thought about becoming an electrician. Well, in mid-53, he paid $4 to record two songs for his mother at the Memphis Recording Service, one of the stops on his truck route. One of the service's employees took a shine to this handsome young man and mentioned his singing ability to her boss, Sam Phillips, who also owned Sun Records. Phillips finally listened to Elvis and was impressed by his innovative mix of black blues and white hillbilly sounds. And he recorded Elvis, whose first songs were more popular with teenagers, if not with shock disc jockeys. Elvis gave up truck driving, focusing on personal appearances as well as performing on radio shows like the Grand Ole Opry. Before long, Colonel Tom Parker, expert showman and career organizer, also an illegal immigrant. That's why he didn't let Elvis perform overseas, because he couldn't be there to manage the money, and he knew if he left the country, he couldn't get back. Well, Parker became his manager, and soon negotiated an RCA recording contract for him. Elvis's first new single, Heartbreak Hotel, was an instant hit, leading to Presley's TV debut on a Tommy and Jimmy Dorsey stage show and Las Vegas club appearances. Later be suggested during this early period, Elvis first became addicted to drugs, especially amphetamine and benzedrine to give him energy. Love Me Tender in 1956 was Elvis's first movie, and teenagers flocked to see Elvis the Pelvis, as they called him. By the time he did King Creole in 1958, he was among the top 10 box office stars and earners. He was earning $250,000 plus 50% of the movie profits. With some of his earnings, he bought Graceland, his soon-to-be extravagant Memphis mansion, whose driveways were lined with Presley's Cadillacs. And by now, his many romances, including Natalie Wood, had added to his growing legend. Spring of 1958, he was drafted into the U.S. Army, and his salary dropped from over $100,000 a month to $78 a month. Served most of his 2 years with an armored unit in West Germany. During this period, his mother died of a heart attack. Celebrated his service release in 1960, Sergeant Elvis Presley returned to Hollywood for G.I. Blues in 1960. And two of his recordings, including Are You Lonesome Tonight, became gold records. Well, during the 60s, Elvis's annual movie excursions developed a casual formula, made their simple plots and songs interchangeable. But they did continue to make money, even as his first fans grew middle-aged and new singers, such as the Beatles and others involved in the British invasion, vied for audience attention. Well known for his extravagant lifestyle and assorted romances, Elvis finally married May 1, 1967. One source insisted Elvis, dreading the confines of marriage, took an overdose of barbiturates shortly before the wedding day. He'd first met 21-year-old Priscilla Braliu when he was based in Germany, and she was the teenage daughter of a U.S. Army major stationed in Frankfurt. Their high-profile Las Vegas marriage did nothing to diminish his popularity. February 1, 1968, their daughter Lisa Marie was born. By late 1960s, Elvis's career was dragging, and his movie budgets were cut to keep the profits up, which in turn reduced audience interest. A comeback TV special entitled Singer Presents Elvis in December 68 re-sparked his professional career, as did his return to performing in Las Vegas in the summer of 69 and also at Lake Tahoe. Well, by 1970, he had stopped making feature films except for career documentaries and began a heavy concert tour schedule. Back in touch with his public, his album sales increased, and he had several more gold records. October 73, he and Priscilla had divorced. He explained, I realized I couldn't give him the kind of adulation he got from his fans, and he needed that adulation desperately. Without it, he was nothing. By the mid-1970s, the sagging Elvis had changed considerably from the slim man of 20 years before. His indulgent, excessive lifestyle and tantrums are legendary, as was the Memphis Mafia, his group of bodyguards and helpers who had constantly surrounded him since 1960. He had an array of health problems, and his increased dependency on prescribed medication was enough to kill most normal human beings. Frequently after his near overdosing on drugs, he'd attempt to kick the habit, but always failed. And by now, he weighed nearly 250 pounds and was dyeing his gray hair black. Nevertheless, his devoted fans remained supportive, and a one-night engagement in Detroit in late 75 earned him $816,000 for one night, folks. At one point, Elvis was considered a co-star to Barbara Streisand in A Star Is Born, 1976. Chris Christopherson took that role. Several associates in this period reported Elvis's fascination with death and his ambiguous remarks about not having much longer to live. In 1977, one live-in girlfriend, Linda Thompson, a former Miss Tennessee, departed, and another 23-year-old Ginger Alden had become her replacement. At the end of June, he returned to Graceland after a Midwest tour, during which a network special was taped of his concertizing. Young daughter Lisa Marie had flown in from Los Angeles for a stay at Graceland. Monday, August 15th, Presley was in residence at Graceland preparing to leave the next day for Portland for another tour. Colonel Park was already in Maine organizing the opening show. And as was typical due to his performing schedule, his days were reversed from most people, sleeping in the days and up at night. And more recently, he had become reclusive and sedentary, especially with his drug-induced stupors. 4 p.m. that Monday, he woke and had breakfast, later playing with his daughter as she raced about the grounds in her blue electric cart. She was to return the next day to California, and her mother, Priscilla, was there to take her back. Original plans for the evening included renting a local movie theater for a special showing of MacArthur, but that fell through. About 10:30, Presley, with his retinue in tow, visited his dentist to the star, so he could have two cavities filled. Group returned home about 2 a.m. on Tuesday, August 16th. About 4, Elvis summoned a few associates to join he and Ginger for racquetball at the estate's indoor court. About 6 in the morning, he retired with Ginger, and she fell asleep, and Elvis took another volley of pills to help him get to sleep. About 9 in the morning, clad in his gold pajamas, grabbed a book about psychic energy to read in his extravagant bathroom on his cushiony chair throne. About 2 p.m., Ginger woke up after surgery for Elvis, found him lying in a fetal position on the bathroom floor. Later estimated during the final seizure, he had thrown the book in a spasm and went forward a few steps before collapsing about 4 feet from the toilet. In the process, he bit down on his tongue. All attempts by Ginger and Vernon Presley, the bodyguards, and everybody else to revive Elvis, including mouth-to-mouth, proved useless. Ambulance was called. Arrived about 2:33 p.m. Paramedics, after putting a life support mask on the singer's face, examined the prostate Presley for vital signs. None were apparent, but they prepared to take him to the hospital anyway. And just as the vehicle was about to leave Graceland's gates, Dr. George Nicopoulos, Elvis's personal physician, arrived and jumped into the ambulance. En route, the doctor massaged Presley's heart, all the while yelling, "Breathe, Presley, come on, breathe for me." Ambulance reached Memphis Baptist Memorial Hospital at 2:56. And there, the medical trauma team worked on Elvis, attempting to revive him. After performing a tracheotomy and open-heart massage, they forced breathing tubes down his throat, and the process knocked out his front teeth. Emergency efforts failed to revive the patient. At 3:30, Dr. Nicopoulos pronounced him dead. The autopsy initially suggested Elvis died of an erratic heartbeat, and it was hurriedly announced to the press that Elvis had suffered cardiac arrhythmia due to undetermined causes. That's what the folks close to Presley wanted the public to believe. As part of the cover-up, by the time the medical examiner could examine Elvis's bedroom and bathroom at Graceland to reconstruct what had happened, the rooms had been cleaned up and rearranged to some degree. Later, more complete tests revealed there were 10 different drugs in his blood, including quaaludes, codeine, and morphine. Some time later, Dr. Nicopoulos was tried but acquitted of illegally prescribing drugs to the star. On August 15th, he'd written 8 prescriptions for Presley, including 2 for diluted strong narcotic. In the last 7 months of Elvis's life, the doctor prescribed nearly 5,000 pills, an estimated 19,000 in the last 2.5 years. Later theories about his death would conclude that Presley had committed suicide, or he was murdered, or the most wish-fulfilling of all, he wasn't dead, he's merely in hiding. Well, at the time of his death, Elvis was survived by his father, his grandmother, Mamie Mae Presley, and 9-year-old Lisa Marie. His will, signed in March of 77, left the bulk of his multi-million-dollar estate for the benefit of the 3 relatives, with Bernard appointed as estate trustee. 1989, 10 years after Vernon Presley's death, the estate was concluded with all property being held in trust for Elvis's daughter until she reached the age of 25. Also in 89, Lisa Marie married a musician, Danny Keogh, became a mother when she gave birth to daughter Danielle. Remarkably, after his death, Elvis's career continued on as if he were alive. Albums, movies, merchandising, impersonators, books, documentaries continued to trade on the Elvis legend. There was even a 1991 TV show, The Elvis Files, which insisted the singer didn't die in Graceland in 77, but was alive and living in an anonymity. Obviously, for many people, Elvis still lives. There was an interesting photograph taken during after his death. It was being photographed toward the house. It was photographing the where he was buried. And in the picture, you can see a person that looks remarkably like Elvis sitting on a couch watching people come up and place flowers on his own grave. Did he die? Well, legally, yes. And I'm sure by now he's dead, if he didn't die then. On that note, we come to the end of today's show. We'll be back in our next show. And once again, we'll talk about the strange and the unusual. Until then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.